Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-5378. Terry Lewis Carter, appellant versus U.S. Department of the Navy et al. Ms. Phillips for the amicus curiae, Mr. Carter for the appellant, and Mr. Thomas for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Anne Marie Phillips, court-appointed amicus curiae, here to present arguments on behalf of Mr. Terry Lewis Carter. To let you know, I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal time. The ultimate issue before this court is whether Mr. Carter can get the relief that he's actually seeking. At its foundation, this case is based on Mr. Carter's honorable service in the United States Marine Corps from 1974 to 1978, at which time he was medically discharged. Despite knowing that Mr. Carter suffered from sickle cell anemia, in October of 1976, the Marine Corps placed Mr. Carter on an unpressurized aircraft, aggravating his sickle cell disease. Mr. Carter was treated and underwent a splenectomy, during which he suffered a traumatic diaphragmatic hernia. Mr. Carter was discharged without proper diagnosis and for over 20 years suffered pain in his left abdomen. It was not until September of 2000 that he was properly diagnosed with a traumatic diaphragmatic hernia resulting from the 1977 splenectomy. At that time, Mr. Carter began the arduous process of bringing this claim that ultimately landed before this court. And Mr. Carter did this without benefit of counsel. In this litigation, the District Court for the District of Columbia made two reversible errors. First, the District Court erred by dismissing Mr. Carter's case with prejudice after he dismissed his own case without prejudice pursuant to Rule 41A11. Second, the District Court erred by dismissing Mr. Carter's Federal Torts Claims Act claims as barred by the statute of limitations. The District Court mistakenly read all of Mr. Carter's FTCA claims as related to his 1978 discharge and summarily dismissed them as time barred. However, the District Court failed to recognize that Mr. Carter had alleged multiple claims for medical malpractice occurring after his discharge that were not time barred or barred by the Ferry Doctrine. Amicus asserts that the lower court's rulings should be reversed and that the FTCA claims should be remanded for further proceedings. Turning to the District Court's dismissal of Mr. Carter's case with prejudice, Mr. Carter voluntarily and without prejudice dismissed his case pursuant to Rule 41A11 on October 6, 2006. 11 days later, the District Court entered a minute order, first recognizing that Mr. Carter had dismissed his case pursuant to Rule 41A, and then stating that the case is hereby dismissed with prejudice.
I realize Mr. Carter did not have counsel at that point, but was there any motion made to the court to correct that prejudice? Was any 60B or other motion made to correct that?
There was none, Your Honor, and from the record below, it appears that Mr. Carter immediately brought his appeal to this court before he ever saw the District Court's order dismissing the case without prejudice. Mr. Carter had an unconditional right to dismiss his case without prejudice. He successfully ended his case upon filing that notice of dismissal. No further action was required by the District Court, and the District Court had no power or discretion to deny the plaintiff his right to dismiss.
Whatever happened in that instance, that affected only whatever is left in the complaint after the prior dismissal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Those dismissals are here on the merits, but assuming they're here. But as far as anything that was closed out by that with prejudice, does that not actually look like an inadvertent act on the court's part?
It's unclear whether it was inadvertent, Your Honor, but it is clear that it was error, and it does preclude Mr. Carter from pursuing his APA claims, which he is not statutorily.
We don't have to look at whether there's any merit in any of those claims or not, though. It's simply.
Correct, Your Honor.
The court just didn't have the power to enter a prejudicial order.
That is correct, Your Honor.
I don't see why it affects his APA claim. As I understand the sequence of events, he raised that in a reply brief, the APA, and the judge said, I'm going to give you an opportunity to amend your complaint to include an APA claim, and that's the only thing I'm going to let you do in terms of an amendment, and he never amended. So when you talk about his APA claim, it seems to me the record is absolutely crystal clear. He never raised an APA claim. Now, if he wants to do it tomorrow, he's perfectly free to do it, and that gets you all the relief that you need on the APA, doesn't it?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I don't think it is that clear. Amicus doesn't think it's that clear that Mr. Carter did not allege.
If we hold he had no APA claim, that the judge could dismiss with prejudice, that gets you all the relief that you could otherwise get.
As long as this court's order is crystal clear that there was no APA claim that is not barred by res judicata.
We try to make our orders.
And Amicus would concede that that does get us through.
This is not to suggest that we always succeed.
Amicus just wanted to ensure that Mr. Carter's actions were preserved because Amicus did not believe it was that clear. However, Your Honor is right. The government did concede that it would not bring a res judicata defense to any asserted claim. So as long as this court's order is clear, I think we would be fine with that. Turning to Mr. Carter's FTCA claims. Amicus cannot ignore the multiple assertions by Mr. Carter, both at the lower court and before this court, that he is not asserting any FTCA claims. On that issue, however, I bring two issues to the court's consideration. First, Mr. Carter is a pro se plaintiff. It appears that Mr. Carter did not have the benefit of counsel in bringing this litigation at any stage. In this court, pro se complaints are to be construed liberally, and as long as they satisfy Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 8, they state a claim upon which relief can be granted. Mr. Carter's complaint clearly alleges multiple instances of medical malpractice occurring after his discharge from the Navy. As such, a liberal reading of Mr. Carter's complaint evidences there are multiple claims of medical malpractice at the hands of the government for which Mr. Carter can pursue relief under the FTCA. Second, Mr. Carter's actions at the lower court and the remedy he is actually seeking suggests that he is pursuing an FTCA claim.
There's still an exhaustion problem there, though, right?
That is the argument that the government raised, Your Honor, whether he properly presented his administrative claim to the Board for Correction of Naval Records. Amicus argues that he did. First, Mr. Carter's petition to the Board for Correction of Naval Records did set forth the damage that he was seeking. He wanted an increase in his military rank and an increase in disability benefits, which the District Court for the District of Columbia has suggested may be monetary in nature, not equitable. And second, Mr. Carter brought before the BCNR all of his tort claims for medical malpractice.
If there was an FTCA claim, it was not affected by either of the prior orders of dismissal, right?
Well, Your Honors, Amicus argues that it may have been. If we look to the District Court's ruling on October 27th, 2006, we see on page 181 of the Joint Appendix the order that the plaintiff, if he wishes to continue this action, shall file an amended complaint which solely asserts with greater clarity his claims under the APA. As such, a literal reading of that ruling does preclude any FTCA claim that he could have alleged, even though the District Court did not see that there were post-discharge FTCA claims.
Can you help me out on it's a procedural tangle. Toward the end of August, was it the 24th or something, that the judge issues a memorandum opinion dismissing all of your, it's not your client, but Mr. Carter's claims, right? And the time for appeal ran on that, didn't it? Didn't it expire?
No, Your Honors, because Mr. Carter immediately filed for a motion for reconsideration, and it wasn't until September 27th that the court reaffirmed that order.
Okay. Somewhere in between there, he filed this stipulation of dismissal?
He filed the notice of dismissal on October 6th, 2006.
Okay. He files the notice of dismissal after the court has already ordered all his non-APA claims dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor.
In that situation, what law do you have for the proposition that he can supersede the court's order, which was with prejudice, by filing a notice of dismissal or stipulation of dismissal without prejudice? Where's the law on that?
Mr. Carter can't supersede the court's order, but the court's order on dismissal of the FTCA claims is not effective until September 27th, after the motion for consideration was considered. As such, the notice of dismissal filed by Mr. Carter only related to the APA claims.
So in other words, a judge issues an order effective 1 week from today, right? And the order dismisses all the claims with prejudice. Your theory is that the plaintiff can then come in and issue and sign a Rule 41A motion and have them all dismissed without prejudice?
He dismisses the rest of his case without prejudice.
The rest of the case?
The rest of the case, not the issues that the district court specifically adjudicated. So it's the remainder of the case.
And the one where the difference becomes cloudy here is the FTCA claim. As to the APA, it plainly was not dismissed, or apparently was not dismissed with prejudice. As to the discrimination and discharge-related claim, that was dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, yes, Your Honor. Unless this court understands both the August 24th and September 27th orders as not dismissing his FTCA claims related to the post-discharge negligence, if the court simply ignores all
of them.
If there
is an FTCA claim.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve the last 5 minutes for rebuttal,
okay,
unless there's any further questions.
Thank you. We have allotted 5 minutes to Mr. Carter, pro se.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Carter.
Terry Carter, pro per appellate. I'm going to try to reserve about 2.5 of my 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Carter, I'm going to have to ask you to try to speak up.
Okay.
I don't hear real well, and I'm not okay. Not getting some of what you're saying.
My position is somewhat does not run along the same lines as the amicus, obviously, from the papers that the court has received. My position essentially is that in a correction of military records case seeking declaratory relief requiring the nullification of a DD-214, which has been alleged to have been fraudulently issued in contravention of law, where there's an alleged extrinsic or intrinsic fraud in regard thereto, and certainly continuing therefrom, the only relevant matters subject to investigation and determination are the asserted facts and legal authorities leading to the decision to issue the DD-214 and such post-discharge factual revelations previously undisclosed subject to applicable legal authorities that give rise to and permit the case and controversy affecting the purported legitimacy of the DD-214 in question. And since this is the position that I'm asserting, all of the collateral claims regarding the Federal Tort Claims Act are somewhat irrelevant from my standpoint, since all of these claims certainly can fall within APA, and since I have basically attempted to encompass them within that criteria. The arguments that I submitted before the district court as well as before this court certainly, I believe, state claim, certainly provide sufficient facts and should permit the case to go on and proceed with the reversal of the district court order.
Thank you, Mr.
Hear all of that?
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Carter. Thank you, sir.
We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, my name is John Truong, and I represent the appellees in this case. We respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's judgment in this case. The district court correctly dismissed the case with prejudice because at the time that the district court dismissed.
You agree the APA claim is not covered, though?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, on five different occasions in the opinion in August of 06, August 07, the district court recognized that the appellant did not bring an APA claim. And that is why the district court allowed the appellant the opportunity to bring an APA claim and amend it as a complaint to include one. So the dismissal.
With reference to anything in the complaint that isn't dismissed in the orders before the minute order stating with prejudice. That's very difficult to follow what I just said. With reference to anything that's left over after those first dismissals. How is the government harmed if we just send that back and say, look, you put with prejudice on that dismissal when you shouldn't have?
Well, the government, for one thing, Your Honor, it is no harm in that. However, the issue here is that whether the judge committed any error when the district court helped along the appellant. because when the appellant, for example...
Yeah, but as far as putting with prejudice on that minute order, did he have the authority, the jurisdiction to do that after the filing of the 41, the voluntary dismissal?
I haven't found a case law that allow a district court to do that. However,
you found some that said it was harmless error, but before we get to the harmless part, you really can't contest the fact that it was error with respect to anything that was left after the prior dismissal orders, can you?
No, Your Honor.
So does the government really care whether we, why would the government care if we said that was error, you didn't have the authority to do that? He probably did it inadvertently, and I think if there'd been an attorney in the case, Mr. Carter, he probably could have come in and made the motion down there and gotten that amended down there. I understand Mr. Carter is not represented by counsel then, but I'm not sure that the government, why should we undertake to weigh the presence even, as Judge Randolph points out, let alone the merits of the APA claim or FTCA claim if there's one left, but all we have to do is say, look, you didn't have the authority to dismiss the prejudice.
Well, given the posture of this case, Your Honor, the district court actually did the right thing by entering an order dismissed in this case with prejudice, because of that order, it allows the appellants the rights to seek an appeal. Because under Rule 41A1 little I, a dismissal without prejudice is not an appealable order. When we were preparing for this argument, we realized that what the appellant was trying to do was to challenge the district court's decision dismissing his claims surrounding the 1978 discharge. That's what he wanted to challenge the district court on. That's why he went ahead and filed.
You already had the August 24th order granting in part your motion to dismiss, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you had the September 27th order denying reconsideration.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So once the case ended, were those not appealable orders once the case was over?
Two things, Your Honor. The answer is no. Two things. Number one, neither the August order or the September order were final judgment, in a sense that there is still a piece of the case left. So therefore, it's not an appealable order. So those two orders became appealable, if you will, only when after the district court entered the dismissal with prejudice.
And you're saying he couldn't appeal unless he made it with prejudice?
That's correct, Your Honor.
He was in error in dismissing the other counts of the complaint, then there's no way that the plaintiff could get it reviewed after a dismissal without prejudice.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Unless the
what's your best authority for that proposition? I don't think you didn't argue it in those terms, did you?
We did not, and in fact.
Yeah. So I'm rather taken aback by it, and I find it rather astounding, actually.
Well, in fact, Your Honor,
I understand the logic of what you're saying, but you didn't argue that before.
That's correct, Your Honor. And to quote Chief Justice Frankfurt when he said this in 1946.
Frankfurter was not Chief Justice.
I'm sorry, Chief, you're correct, Your Honor. And Justice Frankfurter said, wisdom so often never comes, and one ought not reject it simply when it comes too late. And in fact, we didn't understand the whole concept of what the district court was trying to do and what the appellant was trying to do until when we were preparing for oral argument here and realized that when you bring all the issues together, the district court was trying to help the appellant along by entering a dismissal with prejudice so that he could appeal the dismissal of his claim surrounding the 1978 discharge. And the authority that I have with that is that a couple of cases cited in Moore's Federal Practice case. For example, it says notice without prejudice is not appealable. And one of the cases is a 1995 case in the Ninth Circuit. The citation is 62 F3D 1493. And another one is 776 F2D 140, and that is a Seventh Circuit in 1985.
F second what?
140, Your Honor.
Okay.
And those two cases are cited in Moore's Federal Practice, and in essence, what the sort of the error of the law said is that a Rule 41A1 little I, a dismissal without prejudice, is not an appealable order. And so our thinking is that By entering a dismissal with prejudice, Judge Walton allowed the appellant to appeal his dismissal of the 1978 military discharge claim. So that's the rationale behind that. Now, if the court were to remand...
But you agree that the APA claim's not covered there?
Absolutely.
So it's the dismissal with prejudice of the 1978 claims, and maybe if there is an FTCA claim, perhaps that. But it doesn't cover the APA claim, so that Mr. Carter can still proceed with the APA claim.
We recognize that. And in fact, in the district court's opinion in August, the district court made it very clear on five different occasions in that opinion that the APA is not a claim that was initially alleged in the complaint. Mr. Carter, the appellant here, only raised the APA claim in his opposition to appellee's motion to dismiss. And we do recognize the fact that appellant is a pro se litigant, and the complaint should be read to give him another chance to raise the APA claim to the extent that he still wants to do so. So we recognize that the APA claim is still out there, and that if he chooses to, he may bring that claim. And the res judicata doctrine may not apply to...
May not or will not?
May not apply, because I have... may not apply only because a couple of reasons. Number one, this is a...
I read your brief to be suggesting that you weren't going to raise that. Is that true?
That's true, Your Honor. We stated in our brief.
I wonder how the United States can be bound by, in another case, by a statement of counsel in this case. I mean, we're forever being told that estoppels do not apply against the government. How much can we rely on that statement? I mean, there may be a different U.S. attorney, a different attorney general today than there was yesterday.
we did have a new one, yeah, as of last night, I believe.
That's what I was saying, yeah.
Well, Your Honor, the bottom line is, we, as we understand it, the res judicata doctrine may not apply because the APA claim was never raised as an allegation in the initial complaint. We never litigated it, and Judge Walton certainly never ruled on it. So therefore, there's no final judgment, and the parties did not litigate the issue. So putting that together, the under the doctrine, the res judicata doctrine may not apply in that sense. With regard to the FTCA, what is, if I understand the argument here and in the brief, the malpractice that may give rise to an FTCA claim took place after the discharge, but which agency of the government that allegedly committed the malpractice? Is it the Navy or is it the Veterans Hospital? Because the appellant sought medical treatment post-discharge with the VA. So if that's the case, for example, at Joint Appendix 46, there is a list of dates during which Mr. Carter sought treatment for various medical treatment, and those treatments, if you will, were provided by the VA.
Is this argument in your brief?
Joint Appendix 46. Oh, it's not in our brief because, yeah, for one thing, the FTCA was never litigated.
Okay.
So therefore, as a matter of...
But you did at least talk about exhaustion.
We did. Yeah. Sort of alternative argument, if you will.
Yeah.
Our primary argument is that the FTCA was never raised in the district court level, so therefore it cannot be raised here.
And even if it's before us, it wasn't exhausted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I don't know why we need to get into this Navy versus VA.
Well, just so that... There, the element of exhaustion is the presentment, and we want to further that argument by saying that the appellant never presented the issue for the proper agency to process the FTCA, so therefore he never exhausted at that level. That's just the distinction I want to make. But at the end of the day, in fact, on three different occasions in the opinion in August, Judge Walton made it very clear that appellant did not intend to raise an FTCA claim. And therefore, it was never litigated below, and it should not be brought on appeal for the first time here. For the reasons stated in our briefs and here today, we respectfully request that the court affirms the district court's judgment below. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, now I'm advised that there's a problem with the microphone on the lectern. We're going to take a brief recess and let the repair be made. Advise us when we're ready to resume.
Okay.
Stand, please. The court will now take a brief recess.
No wonder I couldn't hear you.
Get some black tape.
You don't have any black tape with you. I'll just use this for right now. It had fallen. Just tell him to be careful with the mic. That's good.
Stand, please. This honorable court is again in session. Be seated, please.
Sorry for the interruption. We're all prisoners of physical settings and technologies. We'll hear from amicus in rebuttal.
Your Honors, it seems that there's a very clear issue here that the October 17th minute order was harmful because it precludes Mr. Carter from ever bringing his APA claims or the FTCA claims not addressed by the district court. The government concedes that there was error. The government's only argument is that the court tried to help Mr. Carter by allowing Mr. Carter to then appeal any issues related to his 1978 discharge. However, reading of the August 24th and September 27th orders clearly show the dismissal was with prejudice at that time. So Mr. Carter could have brought appeal on those issues at that time. He did not.
Well, could he have brought it at that time if the case, if there's no final judgment?
There was final judgment on those issues.
Yeah, but normally we don't hear a piecemeal appeal.
Even if that's the case.
Well, it is the case that we normally do not hear piecemeal appeals until there's a final judgment. It's normally not going to be appealable.
Then, Your Honor,
I will confess that I had not conceptualized this case in these terms either, as apparently you had not, because the government suddenly at the last minute here comes forward with throws a sandbag at us when we get to the courtroom. But
then what amicus would argue is that there was more harm in entering the October 17th order, because it forever precludes Mr. Carter from bringing his FTCA claim that was not addressed at the lower court and his APA claims, which he is not statutorily barred from doing.
It doesn't preclude the APA claims.
It does preclude the APA claim because the final October 17th minute order dismisses the entire case with prejudice.
Well, if the APA claim is stated.
Yeah. Correct, Your Honor.
It interpreted as not covering the APA claim.
If the court finds that the complaint had no APA claim alleged or Mr. Carter did not amend his complaint through later filings, then yes, it wouldn't have. But it would have
the FTCA.
Precluded the FTCA claims.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. So there was error, and that order should be reversed. Right. Unless there are further questions.
Okay, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Carter had a couple of minutes left.
Yes.
Okay, you have a couple of minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Carter.
Thank you, sir.
Maybe I can hear you better with the microphone up there.
Okay. First, I'd like to state that appealing counsel is correct in regard to the position taken relative to the judge issuing the judgment with prejudice. As I stated in my brief, and perhaps therefrom, that is where they made their argument from, there is no right of appeal on a piecemeal a judgment. And my intent at that time was to seek appeal on all the issues, not just the issues that were affected by the August 2006 order, but as well the denial of reconsideration and the denial of the right to file an amended complaint, which would encompass the issues and facts surrounding the February 1978 discharge up through the point where I discovered the facts leading to the APA claim as part of the APA claim all in one, as opposed to a separate, the discharge being a separate cause of action, distinct from the APA claim as it had originally been stated in the complaint. As far as my position was, they were all within the APA, and I was seeking relief under the APA with regard to those issues, since the facts demonstrated the lack of knowledge that would allow me the right of action to pursue the matter at an earlier time. That's all I have to say on that matter, sir.
Thank you. All right, the case is submitted.